Blog Talk Radio.
Friends, you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you?
I'm doing great. Had a great Christmas. I hope you did as well.
Certainly did, yes. Got the holiday thing continuing here. We're working into the big New Year's weekend where we're going to have a big family get together on Sunday. Keeping it going actually.
That's great. Yeah, that's kind of the same way with us. We've celebrated with my wife and our kids, and we've celebrated with my family, and now it's this weekend we'll be celebrating with hers. So it's sort of, after you get married, it seems like the holidays never end, but that's a good thing. You know, I'm not one of those that gets bah humbug after a week or so of it. You know, I enjoy it. It's a good time.
It's fun. Yeah. You know, I mean, Christmas used to be this like 12-day season, right? And unfortunately we created this whole like purchasing season leading up to it, which makes everybody kind of sick of it by the time you actually get to it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like Hanukkah, you know, is this eight night thing. And Christmas is supposed to, you know, it does it, you know, it's like 50% more, right, for your money, right? I mean, it goes 5 days after New Year's even. People are just all Christmased out by the time they get to the 25th.
Well, here's the secret. Here's part of the secret of not getting Christmased out. Amazon Prime. You know, I mean,
explain how that makes all the difference.
If you're not having to run from store to store to store and fighting traffic, it's a great season. You know, I mean, I don't have any problem shopping online. You know, I mean, you pick out the stuff you want, have it shipped to you. And if you're Amazon Prime, that you don't pay shipping costs. So,
Exactly.
It just shows up at your door and then you know. You might even choose to pay for the wrapping, so you just put it on the tree and you're done. You know what I mean? So there you are.
The thing is, we do so much with Amazon Prime. I mean, all of our diapers are delivered to the house, and just an awful lot of like daily necessities we receive via Amazon Prime. That all you notice is it's like a slight uptick at Christmas time. It's like, oh well, you know, we're getting, you know, the UPS guy is coming every day instead of every other day, or wow, he sure left a lot today. That sort of thing. But yeah, I think Amazon Prime is a terrific cure to people who don't really like shopping all that much. And I would put myself in that category. Getting to the mall and like going from place to place and figuring things out. And I don't know what it is. I don't think there's really a difference in price, that big of a difference. I think things might be a little more affordable on Amazon than they are when you buy retail at the store. But
yeah,
it just feels like I'm not spending as much money.
You probably are not. I mean, if you put in, you know, the gasoline, and everything else, and the fact that once you're in the store, the stores are designed to not let you buy one thing and get out of there. You know, I mean, they're basically designed with the idea that we've got you. Now you're going to buy all these things, and the things that you really need are going to be in the back of the store. And you have to make your way through all the other things to get to it. So you end up buying a little bit more than you intended to. Now, I assume the same could be true of a website, but somehow it doesn't seem to be, you know?
You get very specific. It's like you go looking for something, you find it, you put it in your cart, and you're done. It feels like a very controllable kind of process. I want to give a quick shout-out to Ken and to our guests in the chat room. I'm trying to type there, but I'm having a little bit of a technical glitch. I'm not able to put a message into the chat room. So hi chatters. Please feel free to talk amongst yourselves. I'm not able to. Looks like you were able to, Stephen. So I don't know.
I just hit test, so I guess that's working. So
and I should mention thank everyone for joining us. The Speculist was down for a while leading up to the program this evening. So if some of you didn't see the announcement, you might only be listening to this subsequently via recording. Sorry about the site being down. It was just a glitch on our service provider, our hosting provider, a little problem there, but it's been fixed. And, we're obviously back online. All right. Well, we got a terrific show this evening. Before we go into was Santa good to you, I guess, is the question I have for you, Stephen.
Well, yeah. Have you ever heard of a Keurig coffee maker?
Only prior to the show when you mentioned.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that was one of my big gifts, and I have really enjoyed that. I find that I'm drinking a lot more coffee, so I guess I should switch to decaf completely, right? It's just a neat machine. You just you put your coffee in there. You put these little cups. Little plastic cups in there, and you hit it, hit the button, and it brews you a cup of coffee, and it tastes like something you get from Starbucks or something. You know, it's just really fresh and good. So.
Yeah. Well, listen, I don't want to be a bad influence or anything, but a lot of our Humanity Plus friends are all about caffeine as kind of a performance enhancer, and then there's that research that shows that drinking a certain amount of coffee every day might actually help ward off both Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. So
there you go. So everything bad is good for you.
Yeah. Before you go to decaf, you might just want to weigh all that. Okay, that's all I'm saying. Plus, if you drink it long enough, you become completely immune to it. That's why I'm able to sit here and sip caffeine laced coffee as we're doing the program, and after the show's over, go to bed and go straight to sleep. So
after a number of years, you just able to handle it. Huh? That's great.
It has no effect on me. Well, actually, it would have a huge effect if I didn't have it. Put it that way, I would be in deep trouble if I didn't have it. I thought it was interesting. You mentioned that your family got another gift as well, something that we've been talking about on the program and on the at the Speculist.
Yes, we bought an iPad for the kids. Now, my wife had gotten one for her birthday, and.
Or as we like to say, you had gotten one for your wife's birthday.
Yeah, exactly. It's a little bit like that classic Simpsons episode where Homer buys Marge the bowling ball.
The bowling ball, exactly. It says Homer
put on. Exactly. So I buy Sherilyn the iPad with the name Steven on it. And,
preloaded with all your stuff, exactly.
Exactly. We all have a good time with it to the point that the birthday girl was not getting enough iPad time. And so, in a way, by giving the family another iPad, she was getting her birthday gift back. So, that's the idea anyway. So, and the cool thing is, since it's you don't have to buy your apps again. I mean, it's the apps that you purchase for your iPhone or for one iPad, are freely transferable to multiple machines. So. It's all good.
Good stuff. Well, we were talking about this before the show started. I think these two gifts you've mentioned are very germane to the discussion we had on the site last week and on the program last week about the original topic was what's a better e-reader, right? What's a better electronic book reader? Is it better to get a Kindle or is it better to get an iPad? And led to this whole discussion about. Do you want to, do you need a device that does absolutely everything, or is it better to have a strategy where some things do a few things and other things do other things? And I was reminded of an article that I read on the Wall Street Journal site, I think it was about a week ago. I think it was right before we had this conversation, but I didn't have the presence of mind to bring it up. It was about the designer, one of the lead designers, I think kind of the brains behind the Braun company, brains behind Braun, that's kind of funny, the Braun company. They make coffee makers, and they made a number of electronic and electrical gadgets that were very popular in the 70s and 80s. And I think, you know, even today that's a brand name that means something. And he was talking about these items, their coffee maker, their travel alarm, all these items were award-winning for their design. And one of the things he said was that that their design was all about simplicity and keeping everything on a single task. And I think your coffee maker is a great example of that kind of design principle, because it doesn't even make a pot of coffee, right? It makes a cup of coffee.
Exactly. Really good cup of coffee.
One really good cup of coffee at a time. So it's the difference between that kind of technology, very elegant technology that just does one thing very well, and then the iPad, the other kind of technology, which does many, many, many things very well. And so it seems that that the tension between those two positions doesn't go away. It's something that we want some things that'll do everything for us, and the iPad is kind of the latest instantiation of something that just kind of does it all for you. And then we want some things that really only do one thing for us. And I guess my position on the computer versus ebook reader was that I'm not sure I need a device of that shape that does everything for me, because I feel like my desktop does everything for me. Now, I don't want to go back into it, because I know you're going to tell me that I think girls are icky and all that stuff, but which you know is really not true. But I think
now
I think
that you're having there are four children now, you know, I think you're four children into it now.
I'm four kids in, yeah, you know. I must be over that whole icky thing, yeah, to some extent. all that is to say is that it seems that we all, or at least you and I, we both value both positions. We just we look at certain things as being that's what I want to have everything on it, and other things as being that's what I want to have a limited use. So it's not a question of whether one design principle is right and the other one's wrong. It's which item should have which design principle applied to it.
Absolutely. And you know, we've had some fun, you know, having our discussion back and forth on this, but it's exactly. The thing is, we want beautiful products that do their jobs well, and if that is that they are meant to be general things that do a lot of things, that's great. We want it to do all those things very well, and if it's made for one thing, well, we just want it to be perfect, to do that one thing perfectly without any hassle, and so, you know, sometimes we get that. And so
exactly. Well, I just thought it was great that you mentioned those two gifts, because it seems like you've exemplified both of those. Both of those positions. You are, as I said before the program, and I'll say it here, you know, with literally dozens of people listening, a true Renaissance man for the for the coming singularity age. So, all right. Well, having acknowledged that, we've got a lot of ground to cover this evening. We're picking it up from where we left off last week. We got about halfway through the year 2010, and we've been reviewing the year 2010 using some kind of visual aids, some thought aids, some tools from the Popular Science website. Two things that we're borrowing from them. One is I've done a summary, which is available at The Speculist, a summary of their This Week in the Future for the entire year. So all the stories that have links to them that were included in their This Week in the Future feature for 2010 are linked at The Speculist. So I'm kind of working through that list, and then tell us about which part you're working through, Stephen.
I am doing the best of what's new for the year 2010. And I've covered I've got about 11 things here, and I think we covered about 5 of them last week. And so, we'll hit some more of these things too, the best of what's new for this last year.
Okay. Well, so let's dig in. I'm going to just pick it up. I think where we left off was around July-ish. And the first one I'm going to talk about is this story, Environmental Visionaries, The Diaper Farmer. And the subheading here was, Willem van Cotham's Super Soil Harnesses the Power of Pampers to Turn Dirt into Lush Gardens. And this is a really exciting story. I almost let the word diaper throw me off there, because it's not like the guy is planting diapers. What he's using is a technology that was developed originally for disposable diapers. They're called hydrogels, and they're these like extremely absorbent polymers. They can suck up hundreds of times their weight in water. And he has, over the years, developed a methodology for infusing soil with these and turning even very dry places into places that where the soil is so conserving of water that you can, you know, by the old cliche, make the desert bloom. And there's terrific examples in this story of places in Africa where they have taken desert and turned it into working farmland, not by way of irrigation, not by way of introducing new water into the ecosystem, but simply by putting these hydrogels into the soil and making much better use of the moisture that's already there, which speaks to a capability, you know, far beyond what they're currently doing now, which is, you know, to do that widespread, right? To do that with, say, the Sahara Desert, right? The Gobi Desert. One of the comments in the story, Popular Science made note of the fact that a couple thousand years ago, North Africa was the breadbasket of the Roman Empire. Most of the agriculture that fed the entire Roman Empire was done there. They were growing the grains that were eaten throughout the empire. And today, most of that region is desert. You know, so the question is, you know. And this was in response to somebody saying, "Oh, you can't go messing with the environment. You know that the wind picks up those nutrients and puts them into the ocean, and takes them as far as." And people have done studies. I guess, you know, bits of North Africa end up in like Southern California, right? I mean, the wind gets a hold of it and takes it wherever it wants to go. So you'll be messing with the Earth's ecology. But this other commenter points out, no, that's not true. Within human history. Right, within the time that we have records of, this was farmland, and it can be farmland again. So it's really exciting, not only from a standpoint of the possibility of bringing food to people who don't have it, but also just from a standpoint of, you know, generally speaking, we tend to think that the greener we get the planet, the better off we're going to be, just in terms of controlling, you know, if we're concerned about carbon emissions or whatever environmental concerns that you might have. It seems that the more of the earth that is producing abundance, right, that's producing life, the better off we're going to be. And I have a feeling that this hydrogel technology is something that we're going to be hearing a lot more about in the years to come.
Absolutely. Well, I've got something that's very much on point with that.
Okay.
One of the best innovations of this last year, according to Popular Science, is the AquaPro Holland Groesis Water Box. What this is really just a well-designed plastic bucket that basically what you do is you put soil inside of it, you plant a tree or, you know, whatever plant that you want to in it, add 4 gallons of water. And then you never have to add water again, and you just put it out in the desert or wherever. And what happens is it like drip feeds the tree until the tree is big enough that it comes out the bottom of the bucket, and it's big enough then that it can have a root structure that can reach down into the limited water supplies of these drier areas. And they found that with tests in the Sahara Desert, 88% of trees planted with these water boxes survived versus 10% without the water box.
Wow.
And so what they're doing is in some ways, they're halting the spread of the desert and maybe even taking some of it back. And that's the developer, he's happy with what it's doing so far with this, but he's working on a biodegradable version now that's not made of plastic, but of something, you know, that it lasts a while, but then it just breaks down. So you never have to go and reclaim the bucket. It's just the tree just grows right out of the bucket and you never have to worry about it. So
very cool.
That's the same kind of thing.
And what's the secret sauce? What makes it do that? How do they pull that off?
Well, I wish that the only picture that they show here is an exterior picture,
uh-huh.
which shows it looks like a green bucket with a Tupperware lid on it that has a hole for the tree to come out in the middle, and it also has these like channels in the lid of it, so that if you know any rain does happen to hit the box, that it channels it in there where the tree is, but it. You put 4 gallons of water into the bucket, and somehow the bucket drip feeds the tree as it's needed. It keeps the soil around the tree at just the right level of moisture.
I wonder if it's using hydrogels.
You know, I don't know. I don't think so, though. It basically just says it's just an exceptionally well-designed bucket.
Oh, okay. There you go. It's like your coffee maker. It's just
does one thing very well. So
that bucket does one thing very well. That's cool. Question in the chat room: whether the hydrogels are biodegradable? In light of your comment that they're working on making the bucket biodegradable, they're polymers, so I'm going to say no. They're ultimately yes, right? It just takes 50,000 years or whatever to break them down. But one of the points they do make in the story is they're non-toxic. One of the reasons that that it was a long time coming that hydrogels were used for soil treatments was for a long time it was just assumed that they were poisonous, and there have been toxic versions of them for longer than the ones they're using now have existed, which are completely inert and that don't have those kinds of problems.
Yeah. Okay.
So, you know, biodegradable, everything is, you know, you need a long enough perspective. I think that's the real key. Okay, well, here's my next one, and I'm going to come back to this one during the predictions portion of the program. By the way, I didn't mention at the beginning, we're going long this evening. We're not doing just a 60-minute show. We're going to be pushing into the third half hour with our scenarios for not necessarily things that will happen in 2011 and 2012, but scenarios scenarios that we think will be contributed towards in the years to come. In the same way that some of the stories that we're talking about here contribute to scenarios that can be drawn for the future, and I will be bringing this particular example back to that idea a little bit later. But here's the headline. Humanity needs to start farming bugs for food, says United Nations policy paper. And the link is obviously there in the website, but I'm gonna put that one up in the front of the show notes too, because you got to really look at this picture, which is just this elegant little part of a plate setting. It's not even a whole plate, and you've got a nice slice of avocado. You've got several little cubes of what appears to be maybe cheese, or it could be apple. I don't know. It's some nicely cubed something. There's a little gravy boat right behind it with a spoon sitting there in the gravy. And then right in between all of that, flanking all of that, is what looks like a bunch of, like, dried mealworms.
Yeah.
You know, and you look at it and you go, wow, I don't know about this. But here's the premise, okay? The raising of livestock consumes two-thirds of the planet's farmland and is a major source of greenhouse gases. Meanwhile, tons of edible, sustainable protein swarms all around us, free for the taking. In a new policy paper being considered by the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, the FAO, a Belgian entomologist makes the sensible recommendation that the Western world eat more insects. Okay, Stephen, what's your immediate response?
Well, we already do eat a certain number of insects every year. A lot of people are not aware, but that uh, our our basically the FDA has a certain percentage of insect material that is allowed within our food, and our food processors are not to go above a certain amount of bugs in our food. So, you know,
always an encouraging thought. Apparently most people swallow somewhere in the vicinity of, what is it, like 5 spiders a year, right, in their sleep and don't even know they've done it or something. I mean, it's just, you don't like thinking about these things, but it's, you know, some
probably
of the
true.
Nourishment in your body is coming from insects already, or arachnids
right.
in the case of spiders, and all kinds of nasty things. You know, you're breathing in dust mites all the time. I mean, it is happening, but that's all like, you know, sort of out of sight, out of mind, right? So,
exactly.
So here's the question. You sit down to a dinner, and they put that plate in front of you that I just described. What are you going to do?
Well, I suppose it would depend upon the circumstance. You know, you remember the Indiana Jones movie? I believe it was the second one where,
yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Kate Capshaw sits down to that meal.
I had bugs
and
for lunch, yeah.
Exactly. He says, you're insulting them and you're embarrassing me. Said
right,
Indiana.
Right.
In the right circumstance, I guess I would not want to embarrass my hosts. I would chow down on some mealworms, but hopefully they would be they'd be flavored properly so that I could manage it. But anyway.
Well, here's an interesting quote. We're looking at ways of grinding the meat into some sort of patty, which would be more recognizable to Western palates. I think that would make a huge difference, right?
Yeah.
If you give me a bug burger that just looks like burger, right, and I've got mustard and a slab of tomato on there, and right, you know, and maybe some hot sauce, that to me is going to feel a lot different than putting a plate of bugs in front of me. To me, there's a huge difference between those two things. Now, there's still going to be the issue of, you know, I'm still going to be thinking about the fact that I'm eating bugs. But I'm going to be an awful lot more receptive, I think, to eating a bug burger than I would be to eating a plate of bugs. And the more I thought about it, you know, the real direction you obviously want to go with this is sausage, right? I mean,
yeah.
We all know that when we eat a hot dog, we're eating a bunch of bugs anyway, right? We've all heard that.
We hope it's something as nice as a bug. You know what I mean?
At best, yeah. We're eating bugs whenever we eat a hot dog, right? So when we accept it, I mean, we never think about it. You never think about what's in a hot dog. So if they can take bugs and make them into a convincing-looking hot dog, and obviously you can make it look like one, but a convincing-tasting hot dog, and I don't see how that's a problem because they all taste alike. Chicken, beef, pork hot dogs, you know, they're all close enough, right? Have you ever bitten into a hot dog and gone, wait, what is this, right? You know, I mean, you know?
No, it's always a hot dog, yeah.
Yeah, it just doesn't happen.
I've even had the turkey hot dog, and I was trying to taste the difference, and no, it just was a hot dog. So.
It's just a hot dog, exactly. So I think if they really want to make this thing go, this is my suggestion to the food organization, the UN Food Organization, World Food Organization, whatever they're called. Forget the patties and go straight for the hot dog shape. I think if they can get bugs into a hot dog shape, I think we got a winner on our hands.
Well, I think that also would get at what I think is the secret to adaption of this is that don't aim for the adults. You know, I mean, pretty much it's too late for us. You know, we can't be. You don't want to try to train somebody that passed their 40th birthday to begin to love bugs. But if you've got cheap hot dogs that kids would like to eat, and you know they get used to eating that, then it creates a lifelong habit. Maybe I don't know. So
I think there's a lot of truth to that. We could get used to it, but it's a lot easier if you don't have to get used to it. If you're raised on it, it's completely normal because. It's pretty shocking to think about what we do eat. You know, I mean, when you actually see a chicken up close or a cow or something like that, and I don't know how familiar you are or how close you've ever been to the whole slaughter process, right? But I mean, it's really
very close. Very close.
Okay, so you know, right? That it's acclimation with having eaten it your whole life that makes that acceptable to you. If you'd been eating, you know, just oatmeal and rice and stuff your whole life, and then at age 40 somebody came along and said, "Here you go, let's have one of these," right? And they just slaughter a cow in front of you. You probably would, you know what I mean? You would not be into it, right?
I guess that there's the
reason. Be horrifying.
Now there's some really, really good reasons for eating bugs, and I maybe we should explain to our audience why. This particular paper or this particular group of people are pushing the issue. For one thing, it's environmentally sound. I mean, you don't have the problems that you have with the giant feedlots and things for cows and pigs and things like that with bugs. You could raise a whole lot of bugs much more cheaply and much more environmentally sound than you could, you know, for an equivalent pound of, cattle meat. You know, pound for pound is going to be a whole lot easier on the environment. And beyond that, it's going to be cheaper, and you can provide more protein for fewer dollars than any other way. What are the other reasons?
Well, actually, if you extrapolate from those, it's great if we were to start doing, but it's also a good way to make protein available to people's diets who currently aren't getting much, because as it stands now, we eat a lot of meat in the West. Some cultures don't eat much meat because they're culturally inclined away from it, and others don't because they don't have any. Right? It's like they wouldn't mind, but there just isn't much. You know, they'll eat what fish they can, and when they get any meat in their diet, it's just a very rare thing. So to add protein to the diet is a huge just tremendous health benefits for people who are suffering kind of like low-grade malnutrition. We're not talking about people who are starving, but we're talking about people who whose diets don't have sufficient protein in it. This would be a great way to really fortify that and supplement that, and without having to deforest a lot more land to raise cattle and all those kinds of things. So if a certain percentage of the protein that the human population ate started coming from insects, we could dramatically increase the amount of protein that the human population was eating without having all that detrimental impact on the environment. That's kind of the bottom line about it. But moving ahead, there are other things too. You don't have the ethical issues with insects that you would with larger animals. I mean, it'd be hard to mistreat insects, right? I mean, people
we swat them anyway.
What would you do exactly? I mean, a feedlot would be heaven to them, right? They're not gonna have a problem with that.
Exactly. So, yeah, it'd be a great life for the bugs up until they're crunched, and it would for all these other reasons. Yeah, it's a good idea. I just wonder, let's push it on the kids, and if developing nations need more protein, let's make it available to them. I'm just not ready to put down my hamburger just yet. You know what I mean? I don't know. Maybe I'm spoiled. Whatever.
I'm not ready to make
I'll tell you what. If it ever becomes available, Phil, next time we get together for a meal, if you'll eat bugs, I promise I'll eat bugs too.
There it is. Okay.
There's the dare. Right.
If I serve you bugs in my home, you will consume them, I'm sure.
I will absolutely consume it, and if my wife doesn't, I'll say, you're insulting him and you're embarrassing me.
Soraya will say, "No, come over here. Let's have this stuff," right? Because
that's right. Cheryl, you don't have to eat that.
He's insane. I don't know why I let him bring them in the house, but no, she'll be
exactly.
Fine. You don't have to worry.
Okay.
Okay, so no, that sounds good. And my thing is also, well, let me try one, right? I hold out the possibility that I might give out burgers forever, once bug burgers are available. But I'm gonna have to try one first before I make any promises, okay? Because I like a good burger. Let's not be fooled about that. Okay, we're gonna come back to this anyway. So let's move on to what's your next item?
Okay, let's see here. My apologies, I got off track for just one second. Okay. The tallest building in the world is now in Dubai. The name of this building, I'm going to have
it's
trouble
pronouncing. It's the Burj Khalifa.
Thank you. The Burj Khalifa. It is, not only is it now the tallest building in the world, but it is different in the way it's built from any other building that's ever been made. It's basically, you know, there were multi-story buildings before the Flatiron building in New York City was built. But the Flatiron building is considered the world's first skyscraper because, and if you don't know what building I'm talking about the building that was portrayed as the place where the Daily Bugle was in the Spider-Man movies.
Oh, okay.
Does that help?
Sure.
Okay, yeah. The flat building, it looks like it's aerodynamic in one direction.
Yeah.
That is called the Flatiron Building. It's an actual building in New York. And that building was the world's first skyscraper. Not terribly tall, but the reason it's considered the world's first skyscraper is because it had steel construction inside of it.
Mm.
And thereafter, they were able to go taller and taller and taller based on principles they learned, you know, with the Flatiron and other early skyscrapers. This is a totally new way of making buildings. They, in order to do what they did here, they went about it in a different way, basically spiraling up level by level and making it heavier than any building has ever been made. And apparently the weight of the building pressing down is part of what allowed them to build up as high as they did. So
interesting.
It's just a very different way of building buildings. And, you know, some of the cityscapes that you see in movies like Blade Runner, you know, you see these buildings that are like, you know, 300th floor, you know, getting off.
Sure, right.
Yeah, and part of, you know, part of that is that obviously they had, you know, they envisioned this future where the skyscrapers of today are like, you know, are laughed at by the people of that time. And I guess, you know, if we're going to do it, we're going to build buildings like that, we're going to have to learn from this new building because it's just a completely different animal. So that's pretty cool, and that's one of the best innovations of this year.
I love that. I have to tell you that in my day job, I make reference to the reason I knew the name of the Burj Khalifa is because I talk about it all the time. I do database training, and one of the concepts I always have to introduce is the difference between a row-based database and a column-based database. And I use an analogy from architecture. And I'm sorry, what was the name of the building in New York?
The Flatiron Building.
Flatiron Building. I've got to remember that because its predecessor, the last building that was ever built using the old paradigm, because the Flatiron was built using steel beams, right? Vertical construction steel beams. Prior to that, the support for buildings was horizontal. It came from the walls. So the Monadnock Building in Chicago was the tallest building ever built using that paradigm. And they got up to 12 stories doing that. And it's interesting, if you ever go there, that structure is, the walls are like really thick at the bottom and just very thin at the top, because it's, you know, they're like piling the weight on top of the walls as you work your way up, rather than on a as Sally points out, a steel structure that the building is hanging from. Now it sounds to me like with the Burj Khalifa, that they've taken that idea they've improved upon that idea. It's still obviously they're still using steel vertical columns, I assume, but they're somehow arranging those in a new paradigm. Because if it's completely new, then I've been lying to people for years in this training that I've been doing. Because I always say, see, by the Monadnock, you can only get to 12, but now the new way we do it, they're already up to whatever that is, 170 some stories with the Burj Khalifa, and it can go on forever. But
well, let me just read a little bit here. It says the tower's floors, talking about the Burj Khalifa, the tower's floors wind upward in a series of setbacks around a central hexagonal core. The core is supported by one of three legs that forms a sort of flattened tripod. The Burj is stronger for being heavier. The spire alone weighs 4,000 tons, and all that downward pressure helps keep it in place while reinforced concrete maintains the structure's stability.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so it's like they're stacking vertical structures on top of each other to get even more to get even more loft out of it. Yeah, that's very cool. That is cool. And that says to me that if we, when we do get the 300-story buildings, it might be kind of like what they had in Blade Runner, which, you know, those really, really tall buildings were kind of pyramid-shaped, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know,
at least that one building was where they were making the robots or replicants or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Very cool. Well, that's a really neat story, and I'm glad that there are still people making big skyscrapers. I'm hoping that eventually the U.S. starts building big skyscrapers again too, because I think the idea of people are inspired by that. I was in Malaysia. I was in Kuala Lumpur when the Petronas Towers went up. At the time they were built, they were the tallest buildings in the world, and they're still the tallest twin towers in the world. And just the immense interest and pride everyone there had in the fact that that was happening was, you know, it was a very palpable thing. And I think back to the early part of the 20th century when the U.S. was undergoing this huge boom, and we were building really tall buildings. And that went on for a long time up until the I guess middle to almost late part of the 20th century, we were still building the Sears Tower and the World Trade Center and those kinds of things. And now it's not on our radar. I mean, supposedly the Freedom Tower is going to go up in Manhattan one of these years, and it's going to be huge when it does go up. But whereas the Empire State Building went up in a period of time that's unbelievably brief by today's standards, like 18 months or something like that. You know, they've been talking about the Freedom Tower for 10 years, and it's entirely possible that 10 years from now they'll still be talking about it, which is, unfortunate. I think people it's like going to the moon, you know, building a tall building. It's just it's something that gets people's attention and focuses them on what can be accomplished, you know.
And if you're really determined to do it, you just do it, you know. I mean, it's we choose to go to the moon this decade.
Exactly.
And then you do it, and if it becomes a priority, you get it done. So, exactly, yeah.
There it is. Well, yeah. So I hope we get that back on the priorities one of these days.
Absolutely. Okay. What's your next story?
My next story is one we have talked about on the show before, but I had to revisit it. Do you remember this headline? New Japanese telepresence robot pushes the boundaries of creepy.
Yeah. Yeah. And it did. And it does. Yeah.
This crazy little telepresence robot. It had stubs for arms. It was all white. It looked kind of like a gray from UFO lore, right? It was just like this bizarre featureless face, no hair, the advantage of it supposedly is it can make facial expressions. So you can be talking to someone, and the telepresence robot will be there giving gestures that they're giving and making facial expressions that they're making. And you look at it and you go, I would not want this thing in my room. I certainly, you know, in a room with me, certainly not coming to life and talking to me with the voice of someone I care about, right? Because it would just be too creepy for words. And the only reason I revisited this, I think it's important. You know, we talk about this whole business of the uncanny valley and technology potentially leading us into strange directions before it leads us into more satisfactory and more fully human kinds of directions. But I think it's good that some of the things that move you towards the future move you towards the future by warning you about directions you don't want to take.
Right? Not
travel. Because I look at that and I go, man, just no thank you. You know, I will get by just having voice communication with people. And I just want to read this comment. I shared it when we talked about it the first time, but one of the comments on the Popular Science story was as follows. Why talk to your friends over the phone when you can have a crucified, bald, albino amputee impersonate them for you? And boy, if that doesn't just sum it up, you know, I mean, you look at that thing, you go, yeah, exactly. You know, just because it's possible to make something happen doesn't make it a good idea. And this is a creepy dead end. If ever I saw one, I really don't think we're gonna be using those anytime soon.
This is why you have marketing people. You know, this is why what you do for a living is so, so very important, Phil. You know, your robot guy, he makes this. You know, you would take this and you'd cover it in fur and make it all cute, and then it would sell, you know, millions and millions of them. You know, you make some sort of Furby or something.
There you
out
go.
Of it,
or maybe leave it as
sell it as a
Halloween novelty, right?
If you're going for creepy, you can sell it as is.
but certainly not sell as it's currently packaged. You would not sell it as something that people keep in their office or in their home to interact with.
Exactly.
Regular people, like normal people, anyway, would not go for that. Yeah, I'll tell you frankly, I would not want to be the marketing person having to bring this one to market. That would
say, well, why don't we? I got an idea. Let's start over.
Yeah, exactly. Let's do something else. Yeah, that would be my first thought there, for sure.
Yeah. Sally suggests it be turned into E.T. You know, you can sell it as E.T., you know, slightly alter it and make it into an E.T., and you can sell it then. You know?
Yeah, I think if you made him cute, you know, E.T. is one way. You mentioned the fur thing. I think that, you know, that might work. Make him cute, that would work. I would go ahead and, you know, I'd put hands on the limbs, I think. I don't understand this, like, limbs that are there but stop short of the elbows. Is just like, you know, it's a robot. There's no reason why we can't go ahead and put some hands on there, I think. Remember Tom Servo from Mystery Science Theater 3000? His arms didn't work. Nobody cared, right? They were there, right?
He
looked more complete because he had arms. You know, not that that's that huge of a deal, but, I mean, just anything you can do to push it in the human direction, I think, is a familiar direction, you know, just so it doesn't look startling, I think would probably be helpful. But we're spending more time on this than we wanted to. I really just wanted to read that comment again. I got such a kick out of that. I wanted to share it once more.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right. Well, let's see. I guess I need to pull out the next story I was going to talk about here. I tell you, while I'm looking for one, Phil, why don't you hit your next one again?
Oh, sure.
And
yeah, I got a bunch of them here, so I'll keep going. This is a cool one, and you really have to see the video to appreciate it in its entirety. But this is actually I kind of meant to do these two back to back anyhow. So I'm glad we're doing it this way because this is a counterpoint to the creepy. To the creepy telepresence robot. This was Willow Garage's PR2 robot achieves another laundry landmark, this time cleverly pairing your socks. And they have a video of this robot pairing socks, which we would think of as a menial task. I mean, once you start thinking about it, you recognize that that pairing socks is actually this hugely sophisticated thing that we do. In terms of pattern recognition, in terms of the manual skills that are involved, and I was just thinking the other day, while folding laundry, I was thinking about the story we talked about last week, one of my favorites from the year, from earlier in the year, about those students in China, those college students in China who had invented the robot that cooks all those meals.
The wok robot.
Yeah, the wok robot, exactly. We've been automating household tasks for the past century and a half, at least. You know, from the time of the first very crude washing machine up into the 20th century with the first vacuum cleaners, with the first washing machines, the more household tasks, especially drudge-like household tasks, that we can palm off on computers, I think the happier we all are with that. That's just
think of the household thermostat with central air and heat.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, you don't have to build a fire. You know, you don't have to and things like you know, an electric stove. You know, you don't have to build a fire in the kitchen. You know,
exactly.
To cook your food. You know? So,
yeah, I mean,
it's labor saving things.
Truly have, you know, taken hours and hours and hours out of the requirements for what it takes to manage a household, to the point that a middle-class household can function without domestic help, which was actually required a century ago. I mean, you know, I mean, if you were middle-class or better, you had help coming in to do some of this stuff because there was just, like, so much to do in terms of cooking and laundry and cleaning and all these kinds of things. You know, and we have machines to do all of this, but we don't have machines to do all of it. That's the point. When you start moving in the direction of cooking, you're getting to some very sophisticated stuff. And I think from a manual dexterity and visual perception standpoint, folding laundry is going to be like the, you know, it's like close to the final frontier. I think it's one of the last things we'll ever get a machine to do for us, and I'm really looking forward to it because I think that would be that would be awesome. Is, you know, it's like, here's all the clean laundry, now go take care of it, robot. But what you see in this video is a step in that direction. It's not a robot folding all the laundry. It is just a robot going through numerous steps that that are probably taking place instantaneously inside our brains, but it has to go through mechanically in order to pair these two socks. You put the two socks in front of the robot. They're skewed, so it's not like they're right next to each other. It can't look at them and say, okay, this sock and this sock is a pair. The first thing that has to happen is the robot turns the sock and then turns it, and then it's like, ah, I see. Okay, these two go together. Then gets one sock onto this stick, up and down, up and down, up and down, until it's satisfied that the sock is there. Takes the other sock, goes through the exact same process, and finally lands one sock on top of the other. Pulls the two off, and there it is, neatly paired socks. You think, and they even say in the text around the story, this is sped up 15 times. So, and the video seems to go on for quite a while. So this is like, wow, this is a really sophisticated task. And you see the arms are moving very deftly. The hands are moving with, you know, a significant amount of suppleness. This robot is a very sophisticated piece of machinery, and it's making some real progress on a task that we absolutely take for granted, that we don't think of as being that we think of as being very simple drudge labor, but that is in fact a highly, highly sophisticated thing that human beings can do, and that we now see real indications of machines learning to do.
Yep, I'm looking forward to that, and a machine that can actually wash dishes. You know, and when I say, I'm not talking about an automatic dishwasher. I'm talking, you know, take the dishes off the table, take them to the sink, you know, run them through and wash them and dry them and all that. So that's, you know, I'm looking forward to that as well.
Exactly. So, well, what I want is like nanotech shelves that are dishwashers, right? You put the dishes in the shelves dirty, and you close the cabinet, and you come back an hour later, and they're clean, right? That's what
right.
We need.
There you go.
Except you want the robot to put them away, right? That's right.
That's right. Yeah, you pretty much, and then set the table for you, you know.
Yeah, the
food.
Robot clears the table, puts the dishes in the cabinet. The nanotech cleans the, you're right, because you don't even know. You're off watching TV at that point. I mean, you've completely lost interest.
Yes, we envision a world where we have more time to be couch potatoes. That's what we want. Anyway.
Exactly. Okay.
Okay.
Did you have another
next one? Yes, I do. The solar impulse. This was this is a huge deal. This was a big, big deal this year as far as an accomplishment with aircraft. The solar impulse became, in July of this year, became the first aircraft with a human pilot to a solar-powered aircraft to fly over 24 hours.
Oh, okay.
This solar-powered aircraft flew 26 hours, 9 minutes, and 10 seconds before it sat down, and probably just so the pilot could go get some rest. But what it did was, during the day, it collected enough solar energy and enough altitude so that at night it was able to continue through battery power to run the propellers and glide down as well. It climbed to 28,000 feet. And then glided down throughout the night. And then by the time the sun got high enough to energize the craft again, it didn't have to land. It was able to start gaining altitude again. So
wow.
They're hopeful in the next couple of years to make a round-the-world trip in an aircraft like this. And I see this, you know, not necessarily do I see us beginning to, you know, fly around in solar-powered aircraft. I don't think that's really what will happen, but... could you imagine, you know, how useful this would be for surveillance in a wartime theater, you know, around the clock, you know, predator drones that are solar powered, you know, in fields of battle and things like that. I could see DARPA and something taking this technology and running with it. Maybe even in some circumstances it could be used as a poor man's satellite, a telecommunications satellite or something like that.
Well, and in fact, there has been talk over the last couple of years about the advantage of using the discussion was lighter than air, low altitude satellites. There are certain applications of satellites that would actually work a lot better if you weren't all the way up in space. If you had something that was a little bit closer to the ground, and you think about if they can push that a little farther to where it can make a full 24 hours, or if it can get back to the sunlight and then keep going. You know what I mean? It's like hit escape velocity and the thing just stays up. I think there's a lot of weather-related and other kinds, communications and other applications that something like that would have. Absolutely.
Yep.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying, it's a neat one. That's a neat story. I've been wondering because I knew that, you know, a couple of years ago they were working on things like this and they were pushing towards going all night. And actually, I was not aware that that happened this year. I only now in the year end wrap up. I try to keep up with this sort of stuff, and I failed to hear about it. So it's like regular media, they don't make a big deal about things like this. You know, we don't hear enough about these things. They just they happen and ho hum. You know,
they used to. You know what? They used to. There's too many of them now. I think there are too many amazing things happening for them to keep up with it anymore. It has to be like super amazing before they even notice. Because actually, I've got the exact same thing here with my aviation related one, which yours has drawn me straight to this video. Canadian student becomes first human to fly under own power by flapping wings. Did you see that?
No, I did not.
I didn't see it either. I had no idea this had happened. I mean, human-powered flight has been around
since the late 70s,
I'm thinking early 80s, something like that. So that's been around for a while. And, you know,
always leg power, you know. I mean, it was a guy pedaling like a bicycle type thing.
Oh, this is still leg power. This is still leg power.
Okay.
The guy is pedaling, but he's not pushing a propeller. This thing is flapping its wings and flying. It's an ornithopter. it's like... this idea that people were toying with 100-plus years ago, the idea of the ornithopter, I mean, I've never actually seen one that was built that works using, like an engine, like a gas-powered motor. I assume there are some that exist, but an aircraft that actually works by flapping the wings, this is the first one I've ever seen that works. And it's human powered, which makes it all the cooler. It's a great video, and it's a little bit Wright Brothers esque in terms of the flight they were able to pull off here, because this craft, it's just this little bubble under this huge wing, this huge floppy wing that is just a little bit shorter than the wingspan of a 737. Okay, and so this is for the wing for a craft that lifts one person, right? They've got this craft tied to an SUV, so they actually had to get it into the air first, and then he starts pedaling, and the wings start flapping, and there it goes. This thing is flying by the wings flapping. Now, this is not an important technological development in any like direct application sense that I can think of. To me, what's cool about this is just that it's like just mark
sometimes
one more thing off the
because
list.
Because we can.
Yeah, exactly.
Sometimes
go ahead.
I was just saying, you know, sometimes it's important, you know, just to do things because you can, you know. I mean, why do you climb the world's tallest mountain? Because it's there, you know. This is just, like you say, it's another thing we can mark off the list. Fly like a bird. Been there, done that.
We got that. It begins with this quote: when a distinguished but elderly scientist states that something is impossible, he's almost certainly right. When he states that something is impossible, he is very probably wrong. That's, you know, Arthur C. Clarke's first law. And for years, we've all known that it's impossible to – I mean, when I was a kid, it was impossible for human beings to fly under their own power, and we got to see that one erased. But even if people could fly under their own power, there's no way you're going to – fly like a bird does. We have to fly a different way. It's like, now here's a human being flying essentially the way a bird does.
You know, I would think that it would help to be, you know, like a jockey. You know, a very small guy would probably do better with that than, you know, some guy that may have a few extra pounds.
And this guy is actually fairly good sized. He had to lose 18 pounds in order to make it happen.
Well.
The craft itself only weighs 94 pounds, so he was obviously the heaviest. Think about that. This thing's had a 105-foot wingspan, and it weighed only 94 pounds. That tells you something about materials science in this day and age, that craft
awesome.
Like that can be built. Only weighs 94 pounds.
There's nothing not to love about that story. I love that. I love every part of that. You know, that's awesome.
It is totally cool, and you should watch the video. It's great seeing these big floppy wings. They're just kind of slowly fluttering, and there it is. It's flying along. It's really neat. Okay. We're getting kind of close on our time. Do you have more to share?
Well, I have one more story, and that kind of rounds out this group of innovations for the year. This one is AutoTech. This is the best innovation of the year in automobile technology. It's the Porsche 918 Spyder. Now, this particular sports car, this Porsche, has 218 horsepower. Its acceleration is from 0 to 60 in 3.2 seconds.
Wow.
Top speed, 198 miles per hour. But that's not what makes it so, you know, that's not the cool thing about it. Why it makes this list is that it is a hybrid.
It is a
hybrid with a V8 for the engine, so it's a big old engine, but it has three electric motors side by side with it, and it can drive if you don't floor it, it can deliver up to 78 miles per gallon in the e-drive mode. That the electric motors alone can propel the vehicle. So it depends on how you want to drive it. If you want to drive it just all out, bat out of hell, I'm sure you can burn a lot of gasoline. But if you're trying to be economical, you can get a lot of miles per gallon and probably have a lot of fun doing it. So that one got the best automobile of the year in innovation. Porsche 918.
Well, and this really brings us full circle to our original discussion about technologies that are designed to do many things or technologies that are designed to do one thing. And here you've got this whole notion of a hybrid technology. It's right in the middle, right? This is a technology that is designed to work two different ways. It solves two different problems. And it sounds like it does a really creditable job of each of the problems that it solves. One is to be a badass muscle car, and one is to be an energy savings green eco car, and they're pulling both of them off with the same vehicle.
Exactly. It's got an e-boost mode where it'll immediately accelerate. It'll blast electric power to the motors. These are some pretty sophisticated batteries that allow not just a certain amount of current to come out at a certain time, but if you need it, it'll just throw the current to the car. That's very cool. It's a cool car.
That is extremely cool. Well, I've got one more that I'd like to share before we switch over to our second half, which is going to be talking about what happens next in the world. We're going to draw some of these ideas together and give some scenarios for the future. But this story, this is where we would need Brian Wong if we wanted to get deep into this. But we talk so much about energy. And this is just one that I had missed, and I think it's very exciting. Development of tiny thorium reactors could wean the world off oil in just 5 years. And I hadn't read up much on thorium, but 1 ton of thorium can produce as much energy as 200 tons of uranium and 3.5 million tons of coal, according to a guy who used to be in charge of CERN. So this is not a particularly rare or hard to get our hands on metal. This is something that we have a fairly large amount of, and it could produce an awful lot of energy for us.
Well, and you know, the other thing about it, I mean, there are coal mines in the United States where they're just throwing away thorium. I mean, there's just so much thorium that it's actually, it's getting in the way of getting to the coal, you know?
Wow.
And so the reason, and thorium is not any harder to develop a reactor for than uranium or anything else, but the reason we went with uranium way back in the Cold War was we were also developing weapons technology. Thorium is not you can't weaponize thorium, unless I suppose you can make a dirty bomb, a radioactive bomb, but you can't make a self-sustaining explosive that way. You can't make a fat man, little boy bomb out of it, and
right.
The way you could thorium. So. Or plutonium, or something like that. But and so they just put that in. They understood that, hey, that is a potential fuel. If we wanted to make civilian reactors, that's great. But for right now, we're going to continue to develop uranium reactors. And that's what they did. And so we know a lot about making uranium reactors now, and the whole world does, really. And that's kind of a shame because thorium is a lot more easy to come by, and you can't weaponize it. It'd be, wouldn't it be great if the entire world's nuclear power was with thorium reactors? So, you wouldn't have to worry about, uranium getting in the wrong hands.
Absolutely. Well, there's been controversy in Colorado lately about whether uranium mining is going to resume near Telluride. And I think this is – when you look at this, you say, well, there is an understanding that probably for the – for the mid, maybe not the distant future, but and maybe not the immediate future, but for the mid future, nuclear energy is going to be part of the picture. It's going to be it's too powerful of an option for us not to be looking at and not to be exploiting. Here is something that we didn't use initially because it was too clean, too safe. it's ironic, to say the least. All this controversy about uranium, all these restrictions around uranium, and as you said, thorium is something that's considered a waste product when people are trying to get to miners are trying to get to more valuable minerals. I mean, the irony of throwing thorium away so you can get to coal, when the thorium is 3.5 million times more powerful than the coal, is just that is the sort of thing that our remote descendants will look back on us and just scratch their heads in absolute puzzlement. It's like, well, as soon as you knew that, why didn't you change, right? I mean, it only makes sense that you would start using the fuel that's going to produce all that energy. So I think this is a great story because it's one of those the answer was in front of us the whole time kind of moments when you look at it and you go, well, here you go. I'm not going to worry as much about peak oil when I know that we have all the shale and we know that we have natural gas and I know that we have all these other possible options. But I'm especially not going to worry about it when I think, okay, so we've got tons and tons and tons upon tons of this stuff that we could be producing energy from. And if oil reserves got low enough, if all other things worked in that direction and nothing else was working out for us, we could start making huge, huge amounts of energy using thorium. I think that's it's what Brian would say is just another argument against collapsitarianism. It's another argument against the idea that that everything can completely fall apart on us. There's just too many resources out there, and there's too many ways we can turn things around and move things in a positive direction.
Absolutely. I don't think I don't think our danger is running out of resources. If we have a danger going forward, it's the Moore's law for mad scientists. It's not resource depletion.
Right.
Think, so. All right. Cool.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, I think with this in mind, it's time for us to shift gears and let's talk a little bit about where we go next. I've got some scenarios that I want to lay out, and some of them draw on some of the other stories that we didn't get to. And let me start with the two that we've talked about a little bit. One is the discovery of Earth-like planets. We spent two or three shows on that subject over the course of 2010. And I think that that's not just to kind of give an example of where we're going with these scenarios. I don't think that the fact that we're discovering more Earth-like planets means that in 2011 or 2012 we're going to discover life elsewhere in the universe. But I think we're getting on the road to discovering life elsewhere in the universe. I think that it would be a lot less surprising if that happened in 2011 and 2012 than it would have been had we not had the things that occurred in 2010. It feels to me like we're starting to close in on that, and it may happen next year. It may not happen for another 150 years, but it's somehow much more within within the realm of the possible and the probable, the you know, conceivable today than it was a year ago. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree. And you know, we're learning that there are more stars than we were aware of. That was just this year too, you know. Not only did we run into the first Earth-like exoplanet, but also we learned there's like twice as many stars that in this galaxy than we were aware of before. We were missing a lot of red dwarf stars. So, you know, I don't know if red dwarf stars are any more likely to. I don't know if they're likely to be stars that would harbor life. But certainly, you know, knowing that there are more stars out there, that's, you know, that's more resources to go get one day when we're able to move that direction, move out.
That's exactly right. The interesting thing about the red dwarfs is it helps solve this whole mystery of where all the dark matter is. When you look at it and you go, oh, actually, there's three times as many stars as we thought there were, which should be this huge, profound thing. I mean, that should have been one of the top news stories of the year, right? There's three times more stars in the universe than we thought there were. I mean, just think about that.
Well,
that should just blow everybody's mind, okay? I mean, it's like Louis C.K. talking about the fact that nobody appreciates the fact that that we can fly now. You know, we just take things for granted. And maybe that goes to what I was talking about before, that we've heard so many amazing things that we're not amazed by amazing things anymore. That's a huge discovery, and I don't think
we're hard to impress now. That's you know, maybe that's a good thing. Maybe
it probably is. It probably is a good thing. We probably need to be hard to impress, so we don't fall down. We don't fall in traps like I did when I was so impressed by the acid. What was it? The alien life form a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, alien life form. Well, that was, you know, that was a big deal. And the thing is, you know, that was a believable thing. You know, the fact that, you know, that we found phosphorus life. You know, it's reported by NASA.
Yeah, had it been true, it would have been huge, right? I mean, that's the thing.
Right.
Yeah. But you know what? We never even did anything with the fact that there. I kept meaning to put a blog post up about there being three times as many stars in the universe as there really are, and I never got around to it. I mean, what does that say? You know, and we're the specialist, and we didn't. You know, I couldn't find time to write about that huge story. But I think you're absolutely right that story speaks not so much to the likelihood that we'll find life elsewhere in the universe, although it might, because if there's so many of those red dwarfs out there, then we might find that some other form of life has had a much better chance to get going than our form has, just because there's so many, you know, red dwarfs out there, right? There's so many possible possible environments, possible habitats that it could have formed in. For life as we know it, red dwarfs don't look like they would be good stars. They don't seem like they'd be the right habitat. But what that does speak to is, as you mentioned, our long-term future. Our very long-term future. We start looking at this galaxy and at the universe as resources that eventually may be at our disposal, assuming we're the only ones out here, or that we're, you know, working out some kind of reasonable usage terms with other occupants of the universe. Awful lot of material out there to be used, and it turns out this is the form it takes rather than what we thought earlier. So we start to get a clearer picture of what we'll be using, what will be available to us, and what we'll be doing. We still have no idea, right? I mean, we don't know what our remote descendants are going to be doing with all those red dwarfs, but we know they're going to be using red dwarfs. So that's kind of interesting. And I can't remember where I read it. It was in a discussion, maybe somewhere on Robin Hanson's blog. People were talking about long-term future of humanity, And it wasn't so much red dwarfs, but I think brown dwarfs, which are like among the most stable of all bodies in the universe. They, you know, they kind of get into that state and they just stay that way for a long time, relative to our sun, which is eventually going to, you know, nova or, you know, whatever it is that's going to do. A brown dwarf is going to stay a brown dwarf for a lot longer than our star is going to stay the way it is. So if you're looking for long-term stable habitats, and by long-term I'm talking about over periods of billions of years, those might be the bodies with that we actually start moving to. So we're making discoveries now that have to do with these profound steps forward for humanity, the discovery of alien life potentially, you know, the long-term destiny of humanity in the universe. Those big things that will happen one day, we're seeing little glimpses of them with the kinds of news stories that are breaking in 2010, and that I think we can expect to see more of the same kinds of stories in 2011, 2012.
Absolutely. Okay.
All right. How about you? You got a scenario for us?
Well, I don't know how you're going to, you know, basically what I did was I imagined a particular future. I got, you know, imagine, you know, this could be 20 years from now, or 10, 15, 20 years from now. A guy rolls out of bed. You know, he gets ready for work in much the normal way. And I mean, you know, he might be watching news in the shower, something we might not do. But gets ready in much the normal way. But when he leaves his apartment and goes out to the street, he doesn't get in his own car. He gets in a car that is called by a personal assistant, which or a digital assistant of some sort. Call it his avatar or whatever he wants to call it, but that it's a car that's called. He doesn't own a car. Why would he want to? Max, he has to wait on a car to come around. Is, you know, 20 or 30 seconds. He gets in the car. If he wants to save money on fare, he can have it where. You know, automatic carpooling is set where, you know, it stops for other people that are going in the same direction. That's all worked out, you know, in advance. The car knows his destination and knows the destination of other people on the street that need a ride, and so it can stop for other people if he wanted to save money. If not, he could, he could opt against that, pay a little more. Gets to work and probably doesn't work in the same way we do. We tend to, you know, work in one office, one company. That's becoming less and less obvious. Over time, it seems like we're doing more of what he is doing, which is project to project. It's basically an ad hoc group that comes together through social networking or whatever else. Whatever project needs to be done, people are chosen for their skills and are brought together, and they do their project. He shops when it's time for food. Food is not trucked in. There's vertical farming right there in the same city with him. He goes across the street, maybe to a deli on the ground floor of this vertical farm, and is served fresh vegetables. Maybe vat meat. He gets a vat meat burger. Maybe it's an insect burger. You know,
probably
he enjoys
will be.
That. Yeah, and then on the way home from work, his avatar alerts him that someone in the building is sick and would sure appreciate having some grocery and perhaps some medicine brought in, and so he does that not to be paid, but that he's building up favors within the social networking system that he is a part of, so that when he's sick or maybe years from now when he's old, people will bring things to him. And that's the world I'm imagining. So
that's a crazy world. Think about it. He gets around in a car, but he doesn't own a car. He doesn't have a car per se. He works, right. But he doesn't have a job.
He may have, you know, and it may be that just, you know, day to day he may not know what he's doing, you know,
right.
Or where he's going to work.
In a certain sense, itinerant, right? I mean, it's
yeah.
He's a freelancer. So you think about things that we take for granted as being staples of our modern life, and suddenly these are big departures from those. He's a participant in probably still a money economy, but also, as you're pointing out, he's a participant in a completely different economy as well.
Right.
And that one might be as important, maybe even more important than the money economy. Or
that's
is,
right.
Is,
economy,
is increasing
yeah,
in importance.
You want to call it.
Yeah. As he's building up his reputation, because that reputation might be the thing that's getting him additional work.
Exactly. The fact that he's a go-to guy for this project or that project, and he's done these things, and he's building a resume that be tapped into by other people that need a person that's had these experiences, and he's known throughout the world for these particular experiences. So,
very cool. That is a sweeping picture of life in the near future. Do you dare put a date on that? When does the world look like that?
Why don't we say 20 years from now?
20 years from now. I wouldn't be that surprised.
Yeah. In fact, it might come, you might start seeing things like that as early as 10 years from now. But I think you get the full sweep of it certainly in 20 years. So.
Well, Brad Templeton has been pushing for that idea for cars. The first person I ever heard describe that model of how cars should work was Brad at a convergence conference in, I think, 2007. He laid out that model. And when you think about these robot cars coming online, that really does start to make an awful lot of sense. I mean, there's this just-in-time automotive transport concept that I think will take hold. It's just or may take hold. There's the notion people really like the idea of having their own car, but the efficiencies you could achieve with a system like that are remarkable.
Well, one thing that'll make it possible, Phil, is automated cars.
Right.
The car comes on its own. It's not a driver that comes around and picks you up. The car comes and picks you up. You know, when you need a car. You put out word on your personal digital assistant, I need a car. 20 seconds later, a car that's freed up because it just dropped off its last person, pulls up and you jump in,
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it would have to have that level of just in time, instant gratification. As soon as people are waiting around for them, the model falls apart, right? Because then it's the taxi cab model and it's inconvenient, or it's the public transportation model, and people already don't like that, right? they don't want to have to wait around. But if you can make them show up when you need them, and they're clean on the inside, I think that's going to be the other thing is the kind of personal space sanitation piece of it. But you've solved those two problems. Not the problem of having the robo-car that can drive you all over the place, because as we already know, that's a problem that's being solved, that will have been solved within 20 years. That will be probably solved within 5 years, that we'll have cars on the road as credible drivers, as safe drivers, if not safer, than as humans. I mean, we're close to that now with some of the tests that Google has been doing. Yeah, the real problems would be getting the cars to people in time and having it be a pleasurable experience that people consider to be a good substitute for their personal transportation. Now, I want to just take a quick aside from your story, because you went exactly where I wanted to go with. Let's talk a little bit about his lunch, okay?
Okay.
You remember the story we did? We talked about last week about plants that are genetically engineered to produce insulin.
Now we
know that there's all kinds of potential biotechnological applications that can be done through genetic engineering to produce goods that normally required complex synthesis or required a very elaborate means of getting before. Well, let's do a mashup between that story and our story tonight about we need to eat bugs. And wow, hey, what if we have bugs that have been genetically engineered to produce, small quantities of, and I'm putting the words in quotes, beef or pork or chicken, right? What if, just as this plant can produce human insulin, right? What if you had a kind of a bioengineered, cockroach that grew beef, right? Had a little bit of beef on it, and suddenly you could make meat out of these insects, not insect meat, but actually the products that that we normally think of as meat. And in fact, it seems like it wouldn't be even that huge of a leap to get something like a grasshopper to produce something like crab meat, right, or like shrimp or something. You get crab with a K, I would think pretty easily from insects. I think that might well be an intermediate step from the world we live in now to the world where we're producing meat purely in vats. It seems to me that rather than going straight to vats, we're going to use insects as our little tiny vats. Or we could at least use insects as our little tiny vats, and we might start solving this producing abundant animal protein problem with insects, not to produce insects as food, but for insects to produce the kind of food that we want to eat on their very handy little insect scale.
Absolutely. I like that. That's a good idea.
What do you think? Now how would you feel about that burger? Okay,
I feel okay about it. I'll give that burger a try.
Yeah. It, you know, let's not think about what kind of cow it came from.
Yeah.
Actually, it kind of reminds me, speaking of I think we were talking about The Simpsons earlier, the episode where they were going to sell the last ever of the Krusty Burgers. And they were talking about the reason that they had to do it was because the animal they're made from has gone extinct. And this guy's saying, well, what was it, a cow? And he goes, no, think smaller. Think more legs.
That's great.
So I think we might see that Simpsons scenario actually come true. We'll all be eating Krusty Burgers and liking it. Okay, not like Krusty. I don't think he enjoyed the Krusty Burgers much, but I think we're gonna like the Krusty Burgers. I think they're gonna.
Oh, that's great. I love that.
I think they're going to be great. Well, I've got one more big scenario. There's no way we have time for it, so I'm going to save that for a show sometime in 2011, maybe next week or maybe later in the year. But it has to do with my post about Viva La Vida, but I'm going to let that go for now. I think we've laid out a pretty good set of scenarios for the future for the time being.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I guess it's time for the music, huh?
I think let's hear what we got.
The song is New Year's Day by Edwin Derricutt.
Edwin Derricutt?
That's right. New Year's Day is the song. So,
New Year's Day.
Anyway, happy New Year's to you, Phil.
Well, same back at you, my friend. Thanks for putting the music together. Thanks, Sally, and everyone in the chat room. Great chat going on this evening. For everyone who's been part of the program live tonight, thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. A very happy New Year to all of you. We will be on again Saturday evening with the World Transformed Archives, back on Monday with another archive show, and again on live next year, next Wednesday night. So I hope you'll be able to join us for all those programs. And until next time, live to see it.
Volleyball's upon the lawn, despite the hour, I still yawn, and breakfast, it takes all day. Communal channel visiting, a property broker's fairy tales and summer ale and casual smokers. It's New Year's Day, it's like no other day. 10 million miles away on holiday. It's New Year's Day, wake slow, sleep long and late. Like a queen and half a rock's quite a scene. Maddie used to wake up from his attacking dream. Couples doing couple things, I'm thinking of exchanging rings. Captain Kirk has lost his shirt and Debbie's sleeping in.
Sleep long and late. Wake up, sleep long and late.
late, 'cause no one's done.